Dr. Frans de Waal is a primatologist whose observations and writings about chimpanzees and bonobos over the last 35 years have shed light on how and why human beings are the way we are. One of his main preoccupations is the issue of morality. Is it a product of evolution to enhance survival, or is it a accidental byproduct of evolution, a spandrel, I suppose? His primate studies have convinced him that morality and altruism were and are necessary to survival, and that our closest primate relatives display elements of it: empathy, sympathy, community concern, a sense of fairness. I asked Dr. de Waal about the evidence in chimpanzees and bonobos for empathy.
Well, empathy has many different levels, and so at the most basic level we call it emotional contagion, and you see that already in human babies of one day. In fact, they start crying when another baby cries, and that's called emotional contagion. Emotional contagion has been demonstrated in mice, is probably present in all mammals, and definitely present in chimpanzees and other higher forms. When we talk about empathy in psychology, usually we use a more complex definition. It's more than just being emotionally affected. It's that you can put yourself in the shoes of somebody else, that you can sort of adopt the position of somebody else. And that kind of empathy, I think, is more limited. You find that in chimpanzees and dolphins and elephants. So, for example, to give an example of bonobos, a typical case of perspective taking, as it is called, is a bonobo who had found a little bird that had hit a glass wall in its enclosure in a zoo, and the bird was stunned, and it took the bird to the highest point of its enclosure, which was a tree, and unfolded the wings of the bird and tried to send it out like a little airplane, which is peculiar behavior that would not be suitable for another bonobo, for sure, but it seemed suitable to a bird. It seemed to suit the needs of a bird. And so I think bonobos and chimpanzees, our two closest relatives, they are capable of imagining what may be good for somebody else, which is a higher form of empathy.
Can I just check on that, really? Because it could be that the bonobo was regarding the bird as some kind of, you know, paper aeroplane, and it was playing with it. You were suggesting that it was trying to help it become airborne again in the best interest of the bird.
Yeah, it is possible that this was an isolated incident where it was like a toy or something like that. But since we have so many cases of bonobos or chimpanzees doing this sort of things for conspecific, so let's say a young bonobo falls out of a tree and screams, everyone is then surrounding it and trying to cuddle it. So that kind of responses are very common towards their own kind, and actually so common that I have at the moment a fellow scientist who is analyzing 5,000 cases of what we call consolation, a reassurance directed at individuals who are distressed. So that's a very common behavior. And yes, the little thing with the bird could be an isolated case. But recently, another observation was made at a zoo, a different zoo, which struck me as very similar. This was a bunch of ducklings had walked onto the island where the chimps lived, and the juvenile chimps were playing with the ducklings so roughly that these animals would probably die. And an adult interfered and chased away all the juveniles, and there was one little duckling left on the island. And he flipped it with a flip of his wrist, he flipped it into the water moat that surrounded the island. And again, this is very interesting because this would not be a good behavior to direct at another chimpanzee, for sure. But it seemed to suit the needs of a duckling. So I do think that chimpanzees and bonobos take the perspective of others, and we see that all the time in relation to each other. So let me give another example. We have an old female in our chimpanzee colony who can barely walk anymore. She has arthritis. And so each time she tries to join others into some climbing structure where they're grooming each other, we see young females move behind her and push her butt up, so to speak, into the climbing frame until she's on top of it. Or what the younger females also, these are young adult females, what these younger females also do is they run to a water faucet, scoop up a lot of water in their mouth, they approach the old female, she opens her mouth wide, and they spit the water into her mouth so that she doesn't need to walk all the way to the water spigot, which is at least at 100 meters or something like that. So we see that kind of helping behavior that I described for the bonobo and the bird. We see similar sort of things all the time among the apes, and that makes me think that that the case with the bird is not an exceptional case.
This is altruism.
These are what I call targeted helping. where you show helping responses geared towards the needs of somebody else. And that requires perspective taking, and perspective taking, I think, is limited to a few large brain species, such as dolphins, elephants, apes, humans. Whereas the general forms of empathy, which involve being in tune with the emotions of somebody else, you find in dogs and cats and all sorts of mammals.
The idea of altruism amongst chimpanzees has been controversial, has it not? I mean, there are studies that have said there is no evidence of altruism among chimpanzees.
Yeah, the problem is that when you do an experiment with chimpanzees, because in natural life, I think we have a lot of evidence for that. So for example, in the field, we know that chimpanzees help each other against leopards. So a leopard attacks a chimpanzee, then all the surrounding chimpanzees come over and chase off the leopard. Well, that's very risky, altruistic behavior, I would say. So for natural observations, we have tons of evidence, I would say. But in the laboratory, to recreate conditions in which, of course, you're not going to recreate a leopard attack. So you do something simpler. And some of these experiments have not been successful. And negative evidence is extremely hard to interpret. There's one positive study with chimpanzees where they had chimpanzees who had to pick up items for a human observer, I believe, and they were willing to do so even without reward. So there are studies that have been successful inducing, let's say, altruistic actions in chimpanzees. And with monkeys, we have now 5 studies at the moment, and one of them is ours, and I can describe that. We have 5 studies with monkeys that show clearly altruistic tendencies. So let me give you one example of a monkey study that we recently did. We put 2 capuchin monkeys side by side. They normally know each other. They live in a group, and we put them in a test chamber. And one of them has the task of bartering with us. This one gets the choice between 2 tokens to barter with us. And if let's say it's a blue and a green token, and if she picks the blue token, she gets a piece of apple for that. If she picks the green token, she gets a piece of apple, but also her neighbor who sits next to her gets a piece of apple at the same time. So the last token we call the pro-social token, because both monkeys get rewarded. The first one we call the selfies token, because only one monkey gets rewarded. Now, if you give them a free choice between those 2 tokens without at first telling them which is which, because they have to learn that in the course of the experiment, what the consequences are of their choices, they generally prefer the pro-social token. So this is interesting because it means that for them it doesn't make any difference which one they pick, because they get rewarded for either one. But the fact that the neighbor is getting some food makes the green one more attractive to them.
And so that would encompass the other elements of morality, community concern, sense of fairness, I don't know about sympathy.
Well, the experiment that I just described, I would say, is an experiment on pro-social tendencies. Fairness is quite a different issue. Fairness, we also did studies on capuchin monkeys on that and on chimpanzees. Those are elements where we look at are you sensitive to what you get compared to what somebody else gets. And that's actually highly relevant in the current climate in the U.S. with Wall Street, with the Wall Street bankers' bonuses, where the whole country is now upset by the fact that these bankers get 6 million, 10 million, 20 million bonuses. And what we found in our monkeys is that they're very sensitive to what somebody else gets. So let's say you have 2 monkeys side by side. You reward them for a very simple task, and you reward them equally. You both give them a little piece of cucumber. You can repeat that thing 25 times, and 25 times they will do it without any problem. But now, in another experiment, you give one of them, you still give cucumber, but the other one, the partner, now gets grapes. Grapes are far better than cucumber. Now the one who gets the cucumber all of a sudden doesn't want to do the task anymore and gets agitated and even throws his food away. So food that is normally perfectly acceptable and edible, and any time you give a capuchin monkey a piece of cucumber, they will eat it, has become disgusting to them, so to speak.
Inflation has struck the cucumber.
because their friend is getting a grape, and they're upset about that. So that's what I call an egocentric sense of fairness. It's a very self-oriented sense of fairness. The monkey who gets the cucumber is not upset by fairness in general, but more that I'm not getting what the other one is getting. But that's a very fundamental feeling, and actually fairness feelings in children start that way. And the fairness feelings that I see at the moment in the U.S. Relative to the bankers on Wall Street is very much that same thing. Like, why are they getting $20 million, whereas we are paying basically for it, you know?
The, You've studied your chimpanzees at Arnhem Zoo. You've studied the chimpanzees in captivity. Does and I understand the problems of, you know, launching a leopard attack in the search of scientific findings, but does not the captivity distort the behaviour?
The captivity distorts society to some degree, and let's say the activity budget, as we usually call it, in the sense that animals in captivity don't need to look for food. They get their food handed to them. They have also veterinary care, of course, and so when they fall ill, they're taken care of, and that's why animals in captivity often live longer. So chimpanzees live, I think, 10 to 15 years longer in captivity. So the travel that in the wild makes it possible for them to get away from each other, which they do. Chimpanzees, they have a fission-fusion society, so they're not always traveling in one single group. They're split up in small parties, it is called. All of that is disturbed in captivity. But the basic psychology and intelligence of the animal is hardly affected, I think. So, for example, humans live in a very artificial environment, too. We live in a sort of zoo, basically, in the cities that we live in, and we drive around in little boxes. That's a sort of captivity that we live in. So humans live in a very artificial environment, but no one would argue that our basic intelligence and psychology is inferior or different or artificial compared to humans who live in different kinds of environments. And so the basic essence of the chimpanzee remains the same, and reactions to, let's say, let's give an example. Reconciliation behavior, which I have discovered in captivity 25 years ago, is that chimpanzees kiss and embrace after a fight, and so they're making up after a fight. In the beginning, people said, well, of course they do that in captivity. They have nothing else to do or something like that. But now there's at least 5 or 6 reports from the field where people have studied it in the field. They do it less often in the field. Not much less often, but they do it slightly less often in the field. So, but it is not absent at all. And so I would argue that these very basic mental and social processes that you see in captivity, you also see in the field. And we, in captivity, we have a better opportunity to observe and to manipulate. And so you need both ends of the puzzle. Basically, you need to look at it as captivity studies provide one piece of the puzzle, and the field studies, which unfortunately are sort of on the decline because the chimpanzees are on the decline, but the field studies provide the other piece of the puzzle.
The importance of this study that you've done into the existence of morality among primates is that it challenges what you call the veneer theory. We tend to believe that it's natural for humans to be individualistic and selfish, and you say, no, that's the veneer theory. There is an evolutionary fitness which is enhanced through morality and cooperation. Do I have that right?
Yeah, veneer theory is a term that I use for much of the writing of the last 3 decades. Over the last 3 decades, we have learned that we have selfish genes and that by extension we are selfish too, and that morality, if it exists at all, it's basically a charade. It's like we want to be moral to each other, and so we want to show off that we have good intentions because that gets us certain benefits. And everything is driven by this desire for us to get benefits for ourselves. And I've called that veneer theory because basically what it argues is that human morality is not really deep down in us. Deep down, we are nasty and selfish. So morality is a little veneer over the human nature that we use to impress each other, and that's all it is. And this idea goes back to Huxley, who was a contemporary of Darwin. Huxley believed that morality could never have been produced by evolution. Darwin himself, interestingly enough, had a completely different view. And Darwin believed that morality in humans was continuous, which is what he called the social instincts in animals.
He said moral acts as instinct are as an instinctive to man as a deer's bark, a warning bark, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he believed evolution had room for morality. Evolution could have produced morality, meaning that our moral tendencies, and he was very much in line with David Hume, who believed in the moral sentiments, that the moral sentiments were something that was inborn in the human species and that was continuous with what we find in animals. And so my studies on the primates basically confirm Darwin and deny Huxley and deny the veneer theory view that has been promoted actually over the last 3 decades.
Of course, the chimpanzee's behaviour, I mean, talking about whether morality has evolved or whether it's been kind of grafted on through circumstance, the chimpanzees, the primates' behaviour could be cultural as much as ours could be cultural, couldn't it?
Well, there's an enormous amount of learning that goes into it. So you can teach humans to be empathic, and you can teach probably humans to be not empathic at all. So you can manipulate humans through learning and education. And since chimpanzees are only adult when they're 15 or 16, there's a very long learning time in which all sorts of things can happen. And so that's also why one group of chimpanzees may behave quite differently from another group. And so the same complexity that we see in humans, where you cannot really decide, is this human nature or is this some sort of cultural characteristic? That's very, very hard to determine the difference between the two. That same problem we face when we look at chimpanzees is that there are so many cultural influences.
So you're still none the wiser.
Well, it does mean that when you compare humans and chimpanzees, the picture is far more complex than people think. So people often think that if I can demonstrate something in chimpanzees, let's say empathy, and you find that also in humans, that means in humans it's instinctual because chimpanzees have it too. Now, that's a simplification because in chimpanzees it's subject to learning processes and in humans it is. And so you can draw the comparisons and there's probably a biological component to it if both species have something, but you don't know the extent of that.
In Our Inner Ape, you say, and it's a point that I take in the context of morality, we would rather blame nature for what we don't like in ourselves than credit it with what we do like. And you quote Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen saying, nature, Mr. Almet, is what we are put in this world to rise above.
Well, that's a very common perception. If as soon as people maim and kill each other, like in Bosnia or Rwanda or some places like that,
they're behaving like animals.
Yeah, we call them animals, and we are perfectly fine with that comparison. And so, for example, I was recently at a conference on war and warfare, and all sorts of comparisons were being made with ants. Ants do a lot of warfare, or chimpanzees, and everyone is comfortable with those comparisons. But as soon as you say that maybe altruistic tendencies or empathy or reciprocity, things that we actually value in our human societies, that those things are present in animals, then all sorts of questions are being raised. And are you sure? How can you be sure that empathy is even possible in a dog or whatever? And so for the positive characteristics, we are so reluctant. And that is because we want to claim those for ourselves. We want to have humans set apart from animals, and we want to have that be in a positive light, not in a negative light.
I'm talking to Dr. Frans de Waal, who's a primatologist. Let's talk about the bonobo, the forgotten ape, as you called it in one of your books. It's a fascinating primate. It's as close to us as the chimpanzee, but we seem to be a kind of a blend of the loving bonobo and the warlike chimp, just to stereotype it and make it crude. What do you think we're made up of?
Well, the bonobo I sometimes call the primate hippies because they have a lot of sex and they have little violence. Actually, for bonobos, there's no evidence thus far that they kill each other. Whereas for chimpanzees, we have evidence for that, both in captivity and in the field. Not a lot, but certainly more than 20 or 30 cases, whereas in bonobos we have absolutely nothing.
Although, and I know you've been very critical of this, but there was an article in The New Yorker, for starters, recently, very critical of the bonobo, saying it's not as nice as it's been portrayed and they are killer apes just like chimpanzees. You've indeed warned against romanticising them. Do you think that people have romanticised them too much?
Well, maybe to some degree. The piece in The New Yorker I had problems with because the journalist had been 3 days in Africa and had seen he had seen some bonobos walking through a tree and eating some nuts, and he came back with these big conclusions. And many of these big conclusions were actually based, he was railing against captive studies such as my own studies, but many of the conclusions that he came with actually came out of captivity. For example, in captivity sometimes bonobos attack each other very fiercely, and he was describing that. The reason that happens in captivity is very interesting reason, is because male bonobos in the field, we call them mama's boys. They travel around with their mom, and they are protected by their mom, and their place in the rank order depends on the support of their mother.
Because it's a matriarchal society.
It's a very matriarchal society. And now what the zoos have done, and this is stupid, and they have stopped doing this, they have taken the model of many animals. In many animals, the most efficient way to prevent inbreeding is to move males around. Because if you move one male to a group of females at another zoo, all of a sudden there's a new sire possible, and so you prevent inbreeding. They have been doing this with bonobos, moving males around, meaning that they have been disrupting consequently all these relationships between male sons and their mothers. And then the male ends up in a new group of females, where the females are totally dominant and the females beat up on him. And that's what he described in the New Yorker article, without the background of knowing that these were very artificial, disruptive cases that the zoos have now, for the last 5 years, they have not done it anymore. They have stopped moving males around. And so to call bonobos violent based on these disrupted societies that exist at the zoos is problematic. And that's why I objected to that whole description in the New Yorker article.
But essentially, the distinction you make between bonobos and chimpanzees are that chimpanzees can be violent. They do kill. They kill each other. Mm-hmm. Bonobos do not. They, as it were, trade sex for peace.
Yeah, bonobos, for the moment, we don't have evidence that they kill each other. There may one day come some piece of evidence that's possible, but they, most of the time, they are peaceful, and even between groups. So between groups, chimpanzees kill. Chimpanzee males kill males from other groups. In bonobos, group mingling has been described, and what that means is that two groups meet. When they meet, there's a lot of shouting and yelling at each other, so there is some hostility and some chasing of each other, and sometimes even some injuries on each other. So it's not like aggression is absent. But very soon thereafter, the females of the two groups get together and have sex together. The females also have sex with the males of the other group, and then they start grooming each other, and then the adults are sitting around grooming, and the kids start playing with each other of the two different groups. And so it looks more like a picnic in the end than like a war. And that kind of thing has never been described for chimpanzees. That kind of mingling of groups have never... And so bonobos are fundamentally different in how they approach these issues, and sex is a major part in resolving the issues.
I suppose this is a stupid question, really, but why do you think that chimpanzees and bonobos developed so differently?
Well, the one of the theories that we have, and I cannot say that that's going to be the only theory, but one of them is that bonobos live in a richer environment. So they live in an environment where females can travel together and collect their food, because in chimpanzees that's not possible. They live in a poor environment, and the females need to disperse and travel on their own with their own kids to find enough food. So bonobos are in an environment where they can be more sociable because it's richer and there's no gorillas present.
They're in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It used to be called Zaire, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And only, chimpanzees always have gorillas in their environment who eat the ground vegetation. And so chimpanzees have to deal with a poorer forest and less food because the gorillas are eating a lot of it. And the bonobos, as a result of this, they can travel as a group, and the females are together as a group. And the females form a very strong bond, and that allows them to dominate the males. They don't dominate males individually. They're not individually stronger than a male, but collectively they can dominate the males. And so it has created quite a different kind of society, and we think that the explanation is ecological.
How do you respond to the suggestion that we shouldn't really be paying too much attention to the bonobos because they're endangered? So whatever they do hasn't worked.
Well, if that's the argument, then Australopithecus, who is our ancestor, direct ancestor, is not there anymore and has not been very successful. And there's lots of species that have disappeared over time. So I think the success of a species in the present time, like the bonobo would probably be doing fine if we were not logging in the big forests in which they live, introducing hunting and poaching and so on. So I'm not sure what kind of argument that is. Is that there are species who are not doing well at the moment, but that doesn't make them any less interesting from the perspective of evolution.
The difference, it seems, between human morality and primate morality might be that human morality is often an abstract concept and it's impartial and it goes beyond the group, therefore can be completely detached from self-interest. Is that true of either chimpanzees or bonobo?
I have a question about whether human morality is ever completely detached from self-interest. I'm not sure that ever happens, because human morality is very much occupied with community values, and you live in a certain community, so you have an interest in whatever the values the community develops.
Well, anonymous donations to a country on the other side of the world.
Oh, you mean in terms of altruism?
Yeah.
You mean, but morality is much more than that. Yes, in terms of altruism, it's true that we sometimes show forms of altruism that will never give us anything back, of which we can even sure that they will never give us anything back. But I'm not sure that that's an impossibility for animals. So, for example, here around New Zealand and Australia, you sometimes hear cases of dolphins herding people, human swimmers, and herding them away from sharks and things like that. So that's an altruistic act on the part of dolphins towards humans, for which they also probably never get any benefits back. And I think what happens, the big distinction to make is, why does something evolve and how is something used? Empathic tendencies and altruistic tendencies most likely evolved also in the human species to serve the immediate family and the cooperators that you live with. And from those, you actually get benefits back. But once it exists, once the tendency to be altruistic exists, it can be applied outside. And we do that all the time. We humans, we send money to tsunami victims that we will never see, and we will never get anything back from them. And so, yes, we can extend those altruistic tendencies to another category for which it was originally not intended by evolution. And I think the same thing happens in animals. So if a dog saves a person out of a burning building that they don't know, the dog is using a tendency that is very adaptive in its own little pack, but is now applying it outside. And animals do that same sort of thing. Once you have a tendency, you can use it for multiple reasons.
So, getting back to the bonobo and the chimpanzees, you've called us the bipolar ape, as opposed to the bipedal ape, more brutal than the chimpanzees and more empathetic than the bonobo.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have the capacity to be worse and better.
Yeah, when you look at human warfare or dominant politics, you know, power politics, I'm usually reminded of chimpanzees, because chimpanzees have those same tendencies of violent defense of their territory, very tense politics going on among the males and coalitions that they form. And so in that regard, I see a lot of similarities with chimpanzee life. But if you look at humans in their tendency for empathy and their sensitivity and their sensuality, their eroticism and so on, I'm much more reminded of the bonobo. And so we have in us, in our nature, we have captured sort of both primates. And what I'm saying with the bipolar ape is that we actually go beyond both primates, because when we are cruel and nasty, we are much more cruel than chimpanzees are. We have, after all, we have torture and genocide and things like that. And when we are nice, we're actually much nicer than bonobos are, because we have altruistic tendencies that go way beyond what bonobos would ever do. And so I think we have an enormous spectrum of behavior that makes us a very complex primate to study.
Do your findings concur with Jane Goodall's findings, her studies in the wild?
I think generally, yes. I've never seen a major disagreement that I have with her on what she found.
I spoke to her a little while ago, and I'm just wondering whether, I mean, she met a lot of opposition when she said, look here, chimpanzees do bad things. And I suppose you're meeting the corollary of that some kind of controversy when you're saying, look here, they can do, you know, really good things.
Yeah, it's interesting. When Jane started her observations of warfare in chimpanzees, which was in the late 70s, that was exactly the time where the aggression debate was raging. And we had two schools of thought. We had biologists such as Konrad Lorenz, who had claimed that humans are aggressive by nature and that we have an aggressive instinct and that this explains why we have war going on and things like that. And since Lorenz was an Austrian who had served in the German army, his arguments were not taken seriously by a large group of people who felt he was sort of trying to whitewash what happened during World War II. So that was part. The biologists were arguing we have an aggressive instinct. The anthropologists and psychologists at the time were arguing, no, it's not an aggressive instinct. It's we are learning aggression. We are teaching aggression. We have an education system that instills aggression. And those were the two views. And the apes were interesting in that regard. The apes were considered peaceful vegetarians at the time. And they fit with the view of the anthropologists and the psychologists, who normally would never look at apes, but now would say, look at the chimpanzees. The chimpanzees are peaceful. That means that our ancestors were probably peaceful too. Yeah. Then Jane came with her observations of the field where there was warfare between groups of chimpanzees going on. And yes, she got caught right in the middle of that raging debate because she was presenting something on chimpanzees that was not supposed to be true, according to a large section of the academic community. And yes, she had to defend that position, and for a long time, and even today, I would say some, but for a long time people didn't want to believe this sort of thing.
I suppose that's always the difficulty of your jobs, isn't it? Not to see what society wants to see and what you as a product of society may also want to see, but to see what's there.
Yeah, biologists tend to just describe what's happening, and people often confuse that with an endorsement. So, for example, what happens to me often, since I wrote a book, Chimpanzee Politics, which is about power and power relations, if I describe that to biologists, that's one thing, and no one really objects to it, and everyone knows that these things happen. If I describe it to psychologists, what sometimes happens is that they say, so you approve of hierarchy, you approve of power relationships? And I say, I'm not approving anything.
Not a psychologist, actually, but I wanted to ask you that very thing. Do you approve of hierarchy? Because I know you've said that hierarchy is a way of reducing confrontation. People know their place. Monkeys know their place. Primates know their place.
I'm not saying that there is no other way, but I do know that as soon as humans enter a very important cooperative venture, they form a hierarchy. So, for example, the military is clearly hierarchical and needs to be hierarchical, because if you need to take quick decisions, big businesses are the same. If you need to take quick decisions with a lot of impact, you cannot rely on a democratic process. You need some sort of structure that provides you the means of doing that. And so hierarchy, for example, there have been experiments on children, where as soon as children in a summer camp, long ago this was done, if children enter a competitive situation very quickly within the child communities, you get a hierarchy formation and you get a leader who takes the decisions. And so my argument is that if you are dealing with stressors from the outside especially, you need some sort of structure to deal with that. I'm not saying that's the only way of doing it, but that's how many animals do it, actually.
I'm interested in the whole kind of nexus between society and culture and your work. And you've said that when, as a young student, you began observing chimpanzees at Arnhem Zoo in the 1970s, it was a time when power relations and ambition were seen as ridiculous, mm-hmm. and human behaviour was generally seen as cultural and not natural. So, you know, girls and boys could be the same if we raised them the same. And how did the chimpanzees and their observed behavior change your views?
Well, you know, I was at the time a sort of hippie, because at the time, in the late...
You were like a bonobo.
Well, maybe. In the late 60s and early 70s, we had the revolution at the universities in Europe. We all had long hair, we smoked pot, all that kind of stuff was going on at the time. And then all of a sudden I'm plunked in front of the chimpanzees and start studying them. And I was very serious about this, obviously. And in the course of that process, I saw these power struggles of chimpanzees going on, because the first year not much happened, but in the second year, one of the males got challenged by another male, and it became all very tense, and it became all very serious to them. And I was sort of surprised by that, because indeed, in the time, anything related to hierarchical structure was ridiculed by us, especially at the universities, these old professors trying to tell us what to do and all of this. So we were very opposed to hierarchical structures. And in front of me, I saw these animals display it in perfection and being engaged in these power struggles. So it changed my view a little bit. Instead of looking at hierarchical structures as sort of outside human nature, I all of a sudden had to place them inside of human nature, and I had to adjust to that view.
This is a kind of a random question, and I became interested in it having read it in your book. Bonobo and chimpanzee males go for fully mature females. Why have humans developed the youth fetish?
It's an interesting question. Yeah, so I think it is very different for a species like the human that is a pair-bonding species. We have that actually in common with birds. Birds are also pair-bonders, many birds, but not with chimpanzees and bonobos. In chimpanzees and bonobos, it's a promiscuous society where you have males and females. The females take care of all the babies and all the young ones. The males do basically zero in that regard. They fertilize the females and they defend their territory, and they have competition among themselves about who's going to be top male. But the males are not involved in infant care. And that makes that, for example, chimpanzee females or bonobo females, they have a baby every 6 years because they cannot have much more. Because if you travel through the trees with a baby on your belly and maybe a juvenile on your back, you're fully loaded. And there's no way for females to do anything more than once every 6 years. Now, the human species is special in that we entered the savannah and we became pair bonders where males got involved in infant care. And as soon as males get involved, then you can reduce the interbirth interval and human females can have a baby every 2 years, every 3 years, much faster. And we produce much faster than the apes. But this pair bonding is interesting because the pair bonding requires a male to acquire a female at the right reproductive age.
Right.
So if a male were to acquire a female of middle age, then he has foregone a lot of reproductive potential for himself. So a male needs to go for a younger female.
Okay, because human emphasis has to be on fertility.
Yeah, so I think the human emphasis is totally different and relates to the pair bonding situation, whereas in chimpanzees and bonobos, and chimpanzees are very often seen that males will completely ignore these young females. There's maybe 15-year-old females or 20-year-old females. They don't care one bit about these females if there is a 40-year-old female swollen, meaning that she has a genital swelling that attracts the males, they go for the older females. So actually, bonobo males and chimpanzee males, they are much more attracted to older females than younger females.
Yeah. You've studied bonobos and chimpanzees for, 35 years. What was the most recent surprising thing that you observed, surprising to you?
Well, I think these experiments that we have done on inequity aversion, which we just discussed as fairness, I'm not sure that I'm totally surprised that they did it, but I'm sort of surprised that it took so long to discover this, because now that we have discovered it, it seems like a very general phenomenon that has recently been described also for dogs. And I'm convinced that people are going to find it in all sorts of social animals. And when we first published it, there were some objections. People were very skeptical about a possible sense of fairness in primates. But actually, it seems to be now very widespread, and there's already 5 or 6 studies that support the view. And so we found it by accident. We discovered that if we did experiments with our monkeys, if we gave one of them a better reward than the other one was sort of pissed off, just so to say. So we discovered this by accident. And then we read in the literature that economists and anthropologists, they were writing big papers about inequity aversion, and inequity aversion is a uniquely human feature. And so we thought, wow, they're saying that, and I think we have it in our monkeys. And so then we worked on it, and when we published it, it was sort of interesting because it came out on the day that a very famous person in New York, Dick Grasso, he had to resign his position because he had a bonus of $200 million, and people had forced him to resign because they were outraged by the bonus that he received. And our paper came out on that same day, and all of a sudden the connection was made, of course, between what happens on Wall Street and the reactions of our monkeys.
He was getting the grape and everybody else was getting the cucumber.
Yeah, that's what it was. And then the anthropologists and economists, they got really upset with us because we were using the same terminology that they had developed for human behavior, inequity aversion, which is really what we found. We found that these monkeys react negatively towards inequity. And so they started writing papers in a very negative tone that this could not be true. And now, as I say, now there's even a dog study. The dog study is sort of interesting. It was done in Vienna, where they had dogs come in pairs, two dogs who know each other, with the owner. The owner was supposed to stand with his back to the dog so that he could not influence the experiment. And then they would ask both dogs to give a paw, and they would alternate between the two. And if you don't reward the two dogs, they give the paw 25 times in a row without any problem. If you start rewarding one of the two for this task and the other one gets nothing, the one who gets nothing after about 10 times, he becomes slower and more reluctant. And at some point, he starts looking away and he doesn't want to do it anymore. And so even though it's not as strong a reaction as we found in our monkeys, it's very much the same principle. And the reason dogs have this, I think, and you probably will not find it in your domestic cats, is that they are cooperative hunters. And if you're a cooperative hunter, you need to watch what you get when you put in effort. And the same is true for monkeys. Capuchin monkeys are cooperative hunters, and chimpanzees are. If you get that kind of cooperation, you need to keep an eye on what you get out of your investment. And that's where these reactions come from. And they're constantly watching, do I get enough compared to somebody else?
Dr. Franz De Waal, he is giving the Douglas Robb Lectures, Sir Douglas Robb Lectures this year. And you can still catch one of them on Tuesday at the University of Auckland. And you can find details of that on our website, Radio New Zealand. Dot co.nz.